So as we pick up in chapter 18, we're coming now. David has just slain Goliath in chapter 17, and suddenly there's this wonder that, wow, who is this young man who's just wrought such a great victory for us? And so there's a new hero, a new champion for the Israelites. And so we pick up now with David. After that, he finished talking with Saul. Jonathan, the son of Saul, became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return home to his family. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. Whatever mission Saul sent him on, David was so successful that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. This pleased all the troops and Saul's officers as well. So Jonathan, the son of Saul, the eldest son of Saul, who in the natural order would have been the future king, there's already something happening here that Jonathan perceives. And he basically, in a sense, he is just sort of passing that privilege off to David by giving him his robe, his tunic, his weapons. And, you know, God's done something here. Jonathan is a spiritual guy, and he senses that there's something extraordinary about David. Now, at this point, Saul is obviously very happy that Goliath is no longer a threat, and very thankful that this young guy, David, you know, had the faith and the courage to stand up and to win the victory. This guy's great. Let's take him, make him a captain, make him a commander over the armed forces. And, you know, it's all good for a period of time. But when the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul with singing and dancing, with joyful songs and with timbrels and lyres. And they danced and sang, "Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands." So Saul was very angry. This refrain displeased him greatly. "They have credited David with tens of thousands," he thought, "but me with only thousands. What more can he get but the kingdom?" And from that time on, Saul kept a close eye on David. So, I mean, this doesn't last long. So by the time they finally make it back, after the battle has taken place, you know, initially Saul's all excited, "David, you're in charge." And now that this, you know, this praise is going to David rather than Saul, this is too much for Saul to handle. And, you know, we've seen before how Saul is a person who is, he's extremely proud. And of course, this is humbling to him. This is hitting him right in that spot where his pride was. They're attributing greater numbers to David than they are to me. He's going to have the kingdom. Now, remember, Samuel has already told Saul, God has taken the kingdom away from you, and he's given it to another person. The best thing Saul could have done at this point is just said, "You know what? You're right, Samuel. I have been disobedient to God, and I'm gonna step aside and let God's will be accomplished and let him bring his man to the throne." That would have been the right, the good, the righteous thing to do. But unfortunately, Saul wasn't about to do that. So he, from this point on, he sets his sights on David. So the next day, verse 10 says, an evil spirit from God came forcefully on Saul. He was prophesying in his house while David was playing the lyre, as he usually did. Saul had a spear in his hand, and he hurled it, saying to himself, "I'll pin David to the wall," but David eluded him twice. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with David, but had departed from Saul. So what does this mean? An evil spirit from the Lord came. Well, this just means that God now allowed, because of Saul's rebellion and disobedience. Maybe remember Samuel had said to Saul that your rebellion is like sorcery. Your rebellion is like witchcraft. So in his revolt against God, he's opened himself up to a satanic attack. And so the reference to the evil spirit here is basically that God is now allowing, because of Saul's sin, God is allowing the devil to have this kind of access to him. And we notice that when the evil spirit comes upon Saul, he wants to murder David. And every time we see the scenario where this kind of a thing happens, the same thing occurs. He tries to murder David by pinning him to the wall with his spear. And so, but Saul, he's afraid of David because he could sense that the Lord was with David. You know, again, why didn't he just yield to it? Why didn't he just submit? And this is what happens when the heart gets hardened and the mind just becomes irrational. And so Saul is not only David's, you know, making himself the enemy of David, he's the enemy of God, but he's his own worst enemy as well, because everything he's going to do now in the end is going to be really self-destructive. And so he sent David away and gave him a command over 1,000 men. And David led the troops in their campaigns. In everything he did, he had great success because the Lord was with him. When Saul saw how successful he was afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David because he led them in their campaigns. So, you know, in spite of this situation with Saul, this is a good season for David, at least in regard to his relationship with the nation. The people love him. And the armed forces, they love him. They look to him as their leader. And then Saul, he said to David, "Here is my older daughter, Merab. I will give her to you in marriage. Only serve me bravely and fight the battles of the Lord." Now, remember, Saul had said that he would give his daughter to be the wife of the one who could defeat Goliath. And so David did that. Remember, when David was sent by his father Jesse, if you were here with us before, he comes into the camp. He sees Goliath. He sees everybody is fearful. But the men are all talking, and they're telling him, this is what the king promised to do for the one who could slay Goliath. He promised to give his daughter as a wife, promised to give them tax exemption in Israel. So David's already done that. But now notice what Saul is doing. He says, I'll give you my daughter, Merab. Only serve me bravely and fight the battles of the Lord. For Saul said to himself, I will not raise a hand against him. Let the Philistines do that. So Saul he's trying to get David killed. He knows that it's not going to be good for him to do it. So he's going to just keep sending him out into battle. And sure enough, at some point, he's going to end up getting taken out in the battle. That's Saul's hope, and that's his motive. But David said to Saul, "Who am I, and what is my family or my clan in Israel that I should become the king's son-in-law?" So when the time came for Merab, Saul's daughter, to be given to David, she was given in marriage to Adriel of Mahola. So Saul pulls a trick here. Now Saul's daughter Michal was in love with David. And when they told Saul about it, he was pleased. I will give her to him, he thought, so that she may be a snare to him and so that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. So Saul said to David, now you have a second opportunity to become my son-in-law. Then Saul ordered his attendants, speak to David privately and say, look, the king likes you and his attendants all love you. Now become his son-in-law. And they repeated these words to David, but David said, do you think it is a small matter to become the king's son-in-law? I am only a poor man and little known. So, you know, here you see with David, you see the beauty of his humility. So for David, it's like, who am I to become the king's son-in-law? So just these kinds of comments, on the one hand, they show us that we're quite a ways into the reign of Saul, that Saul is very much established, you know, as the king in the sense that this is a major thing in Israel. And so now to be connected to that dynasty, to be connected to the royal family, if you will, this for David is something that he's like, well, you know, I'm just a insignificant, you know, I'm a poor person. I'm not well known or, you know, and you see in David that just that genuine humility, which is beautiful in contrast to Saul's arrogance that has developed. So when Saul's servants told him what David had said, Saul replied, say to David, the king wants no other price for the bride than 100 Philistine foreskins to take revenge on his enemies. Saul's plan was to have David fall by the hand of the Philistines. So again, he's trying to set David up so he dies in battle. So he wants him to go out and slay 100 Philistines and circumcise them because Philistines were uncircumcised and bring back the foreskin as evidence of those that were slain. This is pretty gross. And, you know, I mean, let's be honest. We read this and we're like, what? That's weird. You know, why did they do that? Well, it's just what they did in the culture. You know, the uncircumcised, the uncircumcision was part of the indication of their paganism, if you will, for lack of a better word. You know, they were idolaters. They were worshiping false gods. And the uncircumcision was all part of that. And so they would often refer to them. Remember, David said about Goliath, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? So it was like their uncircumcision was just identified with their idolatry. So in slaying them and circumcising them, it was just, you know, kind of showing a victory over the false God. So, but nevertheless, it is certainly a strange thing. So Saul's plan was to have David fall by the hand of the Philistines. And when the attendants told David these things, he was pleased to become the king's son-in-law. So before the allotted time elapsed, David took his men and with him went out and killed 200 Philistines and brought back their foreskins. They counted out the full number to the king so that David might become the king's son-in-law. So now just understand this. When it says that, you know, David went out and he killed 200 Philistines, this is a battle. He goes out into a battle. Remember, Saul says, send him out there because, you know, in Saul's mind, hopefully he'll die in the battle. So it wasn't just, they just went out and found these, you know, innocent guys standing by the side of the road and they killed him and circumcised him. They went out and had a military conflict and David's army was victorious over them. And so Saul gave him his daughter Michal in marriage. And when Saul realized that the Lord was with David and that his daughter Michal loved David, Saul became still more afraid of him and he remained his enemy the rest of his days. The Philistine commanders continued to go to battle, and as often as they did, David met with more success than the rest of Saul's officers, and his name became well known. Now, notice just in verse 29 where it says, Saul became still more afraid of him, and he remained his enemy the rest of his days. You know, there's a situation here that you have to kind of, you know, see it in the story. But Saul is like David's hero. You know, this is the guy that David just looked up to. I mean, you know, to have been able to be there and to soothe him with his harp. You know, this is before Saul turned against him. And then, you know, having been able to go out and defend the army against Goliath. But you just get the picture that David admires Saul. He looks up to him. He respects him. He's like a hero to him. And then to think of that, but then how Saul turns against David. And so what I'm getting at is, you know, there's like an emotional component here that, you know, sometimes we can read over Bible stories and we just, because it doesn't delve deeply into that, sometimes we can kind of just miss it. But make no mistake about it. I mean, this was, again, when David says, who am I to become the king's son-in-law? David stood in awe of Saul. So now here's the guy who's, you know, just the one he looks up to, the one he admires, the one he's so humbled to be connected to. And he just begins to see the godlessness in his life and the pride and the jealousy and all the ugliness that comes along with that. You know, it must have been a real painful thing for David. And as we go further into the story, and especially when we get close to the end of Saul's life, it just becomes more and more where you see David, you know, in a sense, just so perplexed, like, you know, why are you doing this to me? I thought we loved each other. You know, you're my father-in-law. I'm your son-in-law. But sadly, Saul just remained David's enemy the rest of his life. So chapter 19, Saul told his son Jonathan and all the attendants to kill David. But Jonathan had taken a great liking to David and warned him, my father Saul is looking for a chance to kill you. Be on your guard tomorrow morning. Go into hiding and stay there. I will go out and stand with my father in the field where you are. I'll speak to him about you and will tell you what I find out. Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said to him, let not the king do wrong to his servant David. He has not wronged you, and what he has done has benefited you greatly. He took his life in his hands when he killed the Philistine. The Lord won a great victory for all Israel, and you saw it and were glad. Why then would you do wrong to an innocent man like David by killing him for no reason? And Saul listened to Jonathan, and he took this oath, as surely as the Lord lives, David will not be put to death. So Jonathan called David and told him the whole conversation. He brought him to Saul, and David was with Saul as before. So Jonathan's able to assuage Saul for a season here. But then once again, war broke out, and David went out, and he fought with the Philistines. He struck them with a great force, and they fled before him. But an evil spirit from the Lord came on Saul as he was sitting in his house with his spear in his hand. And while David was playing the lyre, Saul tried to pin him to the wall with his spear, but David eluded him as Saul drove the spear into the wall. That night, David made good his escape. And Saul sent men to David's house to watch it and to kill him in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, warned him, if you don't run for your life tonight, tomorrow you'll be killed. So Michal let David down through a window, and he fled and escaped. And then Michal took an image and laid it on the bed. So it's like a statue kind of a thing here. Laid it on the bed, covering it with a garment and putting some goat's hair at its head or at the head. And when Saul sent the men to capture David, Michal said, he is ill. And then Saul sent the men back to see David and told them, bring him up to me in his bed so that I may kill him. So in other words, who cares if he's ill? Just bring him so I can kill him. But when the men entered, there was this image in the bed, and at the head was some goat's hair. And Saul said to Michal, his daughter, why did you deceive me like this and send my enemy away so that he escaped? And she told him, he said to me, let me get away. Why should I kill you? So she's trying to save her own life at this point. So when David had fled and made his escape, he went to Samuel at Ramah. And he told him all that Saul had done to him. Then he and Samuel went to Naoth and stayed there. Word came to Saul, David is in Naoth at Ramah. So he sent men to capture him. But when they saw a group of prophets prophesying with Samuel standing there as their leader, the Spirit of God came on Saul's men, and they also prophesied. And Saul was told about it, and he sent more men, and they prophesied too. Saul sent men a third time, and they also prophesied. Finally, he himself left for Ramah and went to the great cistern at Sekhu, and he asked, where are Samuel and David? Over in Naoth at Ramah, they said. So Saul went to Naoth at Ramah, but the Spirit of God came even on him. And he walked along prophesying until he came to Naoth. He stripped himself of his garments, and he too prophesied in Samuel's presence. He lay naked all that day and all that night. And this is why the people say, is Saul also among the prophets? So apparently what's happening here is when the Spirit is coming upon Saul's men and then eventually upon Saul, it's they're going into like a trance kind of a state. If you remember back in the book of Numbers, we have there this man named Balaam. And Balaam, although he prophesies accurately, and maybe you remember if you were with us when we studied there, he actually has some of the most amazing messianic prophecies in all the Old Testament. He prophesies of a star that would come out of Jacob. And but yet Balaam proves to have been really more of a, you know, a false prophet in a sense, although he did have these moments where God would speak to him. But he describes his experience. Balaam describes his experience as the one whose eyes roll back in their head. He falls down flat. So there's something that happens to him when the Spirit comes upon him, and he goes into a like a trance kind of a state. So it seems like that's what's happening here. So these guys are going to apprehend David to bring him back to Saul to kill him. But before they can get to him, God kind of strikes them with his Spirit, and they just go into this weird trance where they can't really do anything. They just begin to prophesy. Now, this is pure speculation on my part, but I have often thought, I wonder if they started prophesying about David and his future. I wonder if they started prophesying about, you know, the work that God would do through David and the fact that he was going to be this great king. You know, maybe so. But Saul eventually comes, and of course, he's intent on murdering David, but he gets there and he can't do anything. He starts prophesying as well. But then you see kind of the weird trance part when he falls down naked and, you know, lies in that position. So you see here the Spirit of God's coming upon them in not a blessing way, but in a form of a judgment to prevent them from what they intended to do. And so, of course, there are times when God will do that. We think of Ananias and Sapphira. We think of how it was the Lord who they lied to the Holy Spirit, Peter said, and they were struck dead, presumably by the Spirit of God. So the Spirit of God, of course, comes upon those who trust in Christ for blessing, for empowering, for healing, for, you know, whatever other positive thing you want to think about. But the Spirit of God can at times come also as a restrainer to resist the evil intentions of people. And so I think that's what we see here. So chapter 20, then David fled from Naoth at Ramah, and he went to Jonathan and asked, "What have I done? What is my crime? How have I wronged your father that he is trying to kill me?" "Never," Jonathan replied. "No, that's not happening. You're not going to die. My father doesn't do anything great or small without letting me know. Why would he hide this from me? It isn't so." But David took an oath and said, "Your father knows very well that I have found favor in your eyes, and he has said to himself, 'Jonathan must not know this, or he will be grieved.' Yet as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, there is only a step between me and death." Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you want me to do, I'll do for you." So David said, "Look, tomorrow is the new moon feast, and I'm supposed to dine with the king, but let me go and hide in the field until the evening of the day after tomorrow. If your father misses me at all, tell him David earnestly asked my permission to hurry to Bethlehem, his hometown, because an annual sacrifice is being made there for his whole clan. If he says very well, then your servant is safe. But if he loses his temper, you can be sure that he is determined to harm me. As for you, show kindness to your servant, for you have brought me into a covenant with you before the Lord. If I am guilty," David's talking to Jonathan, "if I am guilty, kill me yourself. Why hand me over to your father?" "Never," Jonathan said. "If I had the least inkling that my father was determined to harm you, wouldn't I tell you?" David asked, "Who will tell me if your father's answers harshly?" "Come," Jonathan said, "let's go out into the field." So they went there together. Then Jonathan said to David, "I swear by the Lord, the God of Israel, that I will surely sound out my father by this time the day after tomorrow. If he is favorably disposed toward you, will I not send you word and let you know? But if my father intends to harm you, may the Lord deal with Jonathan, be it ever so severely, if I do not let you know and send you away in peace. May the Lord," listen to what Jonathan says, "may the Lord be with you as he has been with my father." So you see, again, Jonathan's already acknowledging the future for David. "But show me unfailing kindness, like the Lord's kindness, as long as I live, so that I may not be killed, and do not ever cut off your kindness from my family." In those days, of course, when a king would come to power, they would put to death any threat to the throne. So because Jonathan, in being the son of Saul, was the heir to Saul's throne, Jonathan is basically saying, "David, you're going to be the king. And when you're the king, don't kill me. And don't kill my children." And then, of course, you know, David's not going to do that. But Jonathan just basically reminding him of the covenant that they have with one another. He says, "Not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth." So Jonathan is, you know, indirectly, he is prophesying to David. He's telling David, "David, you're going to be on the throne. May God be with you as he was with my father." His father's the king. "May God be with you when you become the king, and when God cuts off every one of your enemies." And of course, Jonathan is thinking about his own father at this point. So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "May the Lord call David's enemies to account." And Jonathan had David reaffirm his oath out of love for him, because he loved him as he loved himself. Then Jonathan said to David, "Tomorrow is the new moon feast. You will be missed because your seat will be empty. The day after tomorrow, toward evening, go to the place where you hid when this trouble began and wait by the stone Ezel. I will shoot 3 arrows to the side of it as though I were shooting at a target. Then I will send a boy and say, 'Go find the arrows.' If I say to him, 'Look, the arrows are on this side of you, bring them here,' then come, because as surely as the Lord lives, you are safe. There is no danger. But if I say to the boy, 'Look, the arrows are beyond you,' then you must go, because the Lord has sent you away. And about the matter you and I discussed, remember, the Lord is witness between you and me forever. So he's saying, remember the covenant for me and my descendants. And so David hid in the field, and when the new moon feast came, the king sat down to eat. He sat in his customary place by the wall opposite Jonathan, and Abner sat next to Saul. Abner was Saul's right-hand military man, perhaps you remember. But David's place was empty. Saul said nothing that day, for he thought something must have happened to David to make him ceremonially unclean. Surely he is unclean. But the next day, the second day of the month, David's place was empty again. Then Saul said to his son Jonathan, "Why hasn't the son of Jesse come to the meal either yesterday or today?" Jonathan answered, "David earnestly asked for permission to go to Bethlehem. He said, 'Let me go because our family is observing a sacrifice in the town, and my brother has offered or ordered me to be there. If I have found favor in your eyes, let me get away to see my brothers.' This is why he hasn't come to the king's table." Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan, and he said to him, "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman, don't you know, or don't I know that you have sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of the mother who bore you?" Now listen to what Saul says. "As long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Now send someone to bring him to me, for he must die." Wow. So now remember, this is Saul. This is the guy who was chosen to be the king by God. This is the guy who was humble. This is a guy who had a good start, and now he knows what God's will is, but he is determined to kill the person that God intends to put on the throne. Now, that is like some serious hardness of heart. You know, honestly, I am just utterly amazed at how hard people's hearts can become. You know, to me, sometimes it's just beyond belief. It's like, wow, how could that be? You know, how could someone, and especially when we're talking about someone who, is a believer or someone who's been in the service of God, but when they harden their heart and they rebel and they turn and they persist in that, it's just so, it's just beyond comprehension how that can happen. But the New Testament warns us, Hebrews tells us about being hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. Sin hardens your heart. You know, that's why we can't mess around with sin. You know, sometimes people say, "Well, you know, I'm going to repent. I'm going to turn away from. I'm going to stop doing this, but you know, I'm going to do that a little bit later." They kind of have a plan. You know, I'm going to keep doing this right now, but at a certain point, I'm going to stop and I'm going to get my life right with the Lord. Guess what? That's not the way it goes. When you willfully disobey, you are basically cementing yourself more firmly in that disobedience. So the likelihood that you're going to, you know, later on decide, "Okay, I'm done. Now I'm going to repent." That's not really likely. That's why the passage there in Hebrews says, "So today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your heart." Do not harden your heart, because that sets in motion something that can go to a place. Now, Saul, I think, is, in a sense, he's an extreme case, but it's not like he's the only person that's ever been there. And guess what? There are people that are there today. You know, there are people today who were one time maybe doing something like what I'm doing right now. Maybe they were standing in front of a congregation, they were teaching God's word, and you know what they're doing right now? They're out trying to destroy people's faith. They're trying to destroy people. They're filled with hatred and envy. And in some cases, you know, you can turn on YouTube and you can find these guys that are telling people that, you know, there's no God, and how could anybody ever believe that there's a God? And oh, by the way, I used to be a pastor. I used to teach the Bible. There are guys on the internet that are like that. You think, how in the world did they get there? How did they, and you know, sometimes the temptation is to think, oh, well, they never really, you know, surely they never were really right with the Lord. And, you know, in one sense, maybe that's true, but they certainly look like they were. They look like they were right with the Lord. Many decades ago, back in the early days of the ministry of Billy Graham, there was another man who was like a contemporary with Billy, and they were like a team. They were an evangelistic team. And his name was Charles Templeton. And so it was Billy Graham and Charles Templeton, and they were like the dynamic duo, you know, and they would go into places, and they were both with the Youth for Christ ministry, and they would go and they would preach, and people would get converted. And Charles Templeton was every much the equal of Billy in many ways. And yet at a certain point, he renounced his faith and ended up, you know, denying the faith and ended up becoming pretty much an atheist. And not just an atheist, not just a passive atheist, but an aggressive atheist who, you know, sought to destroy the faith of other people. And, you know, when it was all said and done, one of the things that was happening back in those days that nobody knew is he was having an affair with a woman. He was being unfaithful to his wife. He was still doing all the outward ministry stuff. And then his sort of his pretext for walking away from the faith was, you know, he had been enlightened. He had been studying the original text, and he began to realize that there were many problems with the Bible. This is all the reasons why he gave for his unbelief, when the fact of the matter was he was having an affair. You know, there's a pastor named Mark Driscoll who years ago, he said this, and he said, you know, when somebody tells me, you know, they kind of come and say like, well, I don't believe, I'm not following Christ, I don't believe the Bible, blah, 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 whatever, all their intellectual reasons. He said, I listen to him, and then I just ask him this question. So who are you sleeping with? Because yeah, that's the reality. It's never what it appears to be. You know, people come, oh, yeah, I'm just too smart now to believe the Bible. You know, I went to college. I sat in a philosophy class, so now I know it's not true. But the reality is, it's always a moral issue. And so Saul, as we've already seen, you know, Saul's issues are rebellion and pride and wanting to do things his own way. And now he's at a place where he's like, you know, tell me where David is because I've got to kill him. Because, you know, if I don't kill him, you can't be the king. Well, God's already told Saul that we're done with you and your family. So all that to say, don't let your heart get hard. Man, like, again, like it says in Hebrews, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your heart. The best thing you can do is just repent quick. And just like, Lord, I don't want to go there. Forgive me. I'm sorry. Don't let that go on, because it'll go from bad to worse. That's what happens. So Jonathan's great. He's so courageous. He says, why should he be put to death? What has he done? Jonathan asked his father, but Saul hurled his spear at him to kill him. Now, Saul is really out of his mind. I think you can safely say he's lost his mind, but he's lost his mind because of his rebellion. I think I've mentioned this before, but there is what I like to call a sin-induced insanity. Saul's insane, but he's insane because he's in rebellion to God. And so now he's even trying to kill his son. He's throwing a spear at Jonathan. That's how out of control he is. And so Jonathan got up from the table in fierce anger. On that second day of the feast, he did not eat because he was grieved at his father's shameful treatment of David. In the morning, Jonathan went out to the field for his meeting with David. He had a small boy with him, and he said to the boy, run and find the arrows I shoot. As the boy ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. And when the boy came to the place where Jonathan's arrow had fallen, Jonathan called out after him, "Isn't the arrow beyond you?" Then he shouted, "Hurry, go quickly, don't stop." The boy picked up the arrow and returned to his master. The boy knew nothing about all this. Only Jonathan and David knew. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to the boy and said, "Go, carry them back to town." And after the boy had gone, David got up from the south side of the stone and bowed down before Jonathan three times with his face to the ground. Then they kissed each other and wept together, but David wept the most. Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, for we have sworn friendship with each other in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord is witness between you and me and between your descendants and my descendants forever.'" Then David left and Jonathan went back to the town. This was the last time they would ever see each other. Sad, sad moment. So David went to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest. Ahimelech trembled when he met him and asked, "Why are you alone? Why is no one with you?" And David answered Ahimelech the priest, "The king sent me on a mission and said to me, 'No one is to know anything about the mission I am sending you on. As for my men, I have told them to meet me at a certain place. Now then, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever you can find.' But the priest answered David, 'I don't have any ordinary bread on hand. However, there is some consecrated bread here, provided the men have kept themselves from women, kept themselves from sexual relations.' David replied, 'Indeed, the women have been kept from us as usual whenever I set out. The men's bodies are holy, even on missions that are not holy. How much more so today?' So the priest gave him the consecrated bread, since there was no bread there except the bread of the presence." Now, maybe you remember when we studied the tabernacle, there's what's called the showbread or the bread of the presence. That's the bread that they're talking about here. So in the tabernacle, you went into that holy place and there was the candle stand, and there was the table with the showbread, and this was exclusively for the priest. But David says, "My men are hungry." The priest says, "Well, this is the only bread I have." And so the priest gave him the consecrated bread, since there was no other bread. And so he removed it from before the Lord and replaced it by hot bread on the day that it was taken. Now, Jesus, maybe you remember this, in the Gospels, Jesus refers to this event. And Jesus uses this story when the Pharisees are criticizing him because his disciples are eating. They're eating with unwashed hands, or they're plucking grains on the Sabbath day. They're doing something in the minds of the people or the Pharisees that is a violation of the Sabbath. And Jesus said, "Haven't you ever read what David did when he was hungry, how he went into the temple and he ate the bread that was really unlawful to eat?" But the point that Jesus was making was that, and the Pharisees were accusing him of Sabbath breaking, Jesus said, "You know, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath." So in other words, what Jesus is saying is the need of man takes precedence over these ceremonial things. And so, of course, during the time of Saul, everything was so in disarray. And, you know, Saul's trying to kill David, God's anointed king and all that. So the bread at this point, the bread is really, it's perfectly fine to nourish David, God's servant. But Jesus alludes to this here. Now, another thing that is just a quick side note. Notice that Ahimelech is the priest. And in the New Testament, it refers to in the days of Abiathar. It says Abiathar rather than Ahimelech. Now, we'll read Abiathar's name in a moment because he comes up here. But, you know, some have criticized the Bible and said, "Oh, the Bible's in error. It's made a mistake. It says that Abiathar was the priest when it was really Ahimelech." And actually, one guy, a well-known scholar who pretty much renounced his faith and, you know, functions more as an atheist these days. Bart Ehrman is his name. He said that this was the passage that proved to him that the Bible wasn't inspired. Because the text says, in the days of Ahimelech, Jesus said, in the days of Abiathar, obviously, somebody's mistaken, so there's a mistake in the Bible, so therefore it can't be inspired. And I think, wow, a New Testament scholar couldn't figure that out? I mean, I can figure that out, and I'm not even a New Testament scholar. So what's the answer to the riddle? The answer is that quite often, and we have even a New Testament example, the priest and his son served simultaneously. They served together. So when Jesus says Abiathar, yes, Abiathar was serving with Ahimelech at the time. And from the New Testament, like I said, we have an example, because have you ever noticed in the New Testament, we have two high priests. We have Caiaphas and we have Annas. And they're both referred to as the high priest at the same time. As a matter of fact, in the trial of Jesus, they're referenced to Annas the high priest, there's a reference to Caiaphas the high priest. These are two different people, but they're father, and in this case, father and son-in-law. So the things that people give up their faith for is just, sometimes it's utterly astounding to think that, you know, this was the thing. But then, of course, like I was saying about Charles Templeton earlier, when time goes on and you kind of start to see the background, you find that there were other factors at work that really were a better explanation for why somebody like Bart Ehrman has, you know, lost his faith. At least he has at this point, or seemed to have, anyway. So now one of Saul's servants was there that day, detained before the Lord. So he's in Nob, this person, and his name was Doeg, the Edomite, and he was Saul's chief shepherd. I like to just drop the E. His name was Dog. Because this guy is a dog. He's a ravenous wolf. So David asked Ahimelech, do you not have a spear? Now, okay, think about this for a second before we read this next verse, couple verses. So David, look how everything has turned. I mean, you know, David at one time, he is like, you know, he is just in this place of absolute, you know, he's been anointed. He was anointed by Samuel. And then he slays Goliath. And then he's elevated to this position within the kingdom, the military. He becomes the king's son-in-law. You know, and in these early days, it's like, man, things are just going great. David looked like a guy who had been anointed. It's like, this is what you'd expect when somebody gets anointed. Man, God pours his spirit on them, and look at what they, you know, look at the heights that David arrived at so quickly. But now look what's happening. He's descending into a pit. And, you know, whenever we descend into a pit as believers, you know, maybe we go from some height and then we go down into a low thing. The thing we're always tempted to think is, well, somehow God's blessing must have left me, or God's anointed must have left me, or I must have done something to cause God to be angry with me, and that's why everything's turned the wrong way. But none of that was true with David. David's still God's anointed. He's still the guy that God is going to raise up to be the king. And, of course, we know the end of the story. He's not just going to be the king. He's going to be the ancestor of the Messiah. Then what's the explanation for what's happening with David? Well, God is going to prepare David to be the king. And in preparation, there are battles that are fought. And there are victories that are wrought, and there are times when it looks like there are defeats along the way as well. But even those things that look like defeats, God is using those things to fashion and to form men and women into the instrument that he wants them to be. So So David's now, he's descending into this pit of suffering, really. And I would imagine at this very moment, David could have easily been tempted toward despondency. Because after all, man, you know, everything has gone so wrong. And now it is crystal clear. Saul is dead set on killing him, and he can no longer stay. He's got to go. He's become now an exile. But look what happens. This is, with that background, look at these next two verses. David asked Ahimelech, "Do you have a spear or sword here? I haven't brought my sword or any weapon because the king's mission was urgent." The priest replied, "The sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah, is here. It is wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you want it, take it. There is no sword here but that one." David said, "There is none like it. Give it to me." This, I believe that this is a moment where God is reminding David, "I am with you. Remember Goliath. Remember what I did through you." And even though he's going to, you know, in a sense, spiral down deeper and deeper into this pit with Saul relentlessly pursuing him and seeking to kill him, it's almost like before he, you know, plunges any deeper, God's just sending him a reminder, "I'm with you. You didn't slay Goliath on your own. That was the hand of the Lord." And I'm just guessing here, but I would say that this would have been a moment for David that just it just sent just enough of a flash across his mind of the promises of God that he was able to regroup and keep going forward. And you know, the Lord will do that at times. He will do just that. He will just send a thought your way to remind you of some blessing, something in your life that he did, and he's saying to you, "Hey, I'm with you. Don't forget it, even when you feel like I'm not. Even when you're maybe down there in that pit." David's going to go to a place called the Cave of Adullam, and that's where he's going to be hanging out for a while. But the Lord wants him to know that I'm with you. And of course, in the process of time, God's going to fulfill all of his promises to David. So that day, David fled from Saul. He went to Achish. Look where he went. He went to Achish, king of Gath. The name Gath. Goliath of Gath. David went to Philistia. He went down to the area where Goliath was actually from. But the servants of Achish said to him, "Isn't this David, the king of the land? Isn't this the one they sing about in their dances? Saul has slain his thousand and David his tens of thousands." And David took these words to heart and was very much afraid of Achish, king of Gath. So who knows why David went there? He might have thought that he was going to somehow hide, but they recognized him. So when Achish finds out who David is, so David pretended to be insane in their presence. And while he was in their hands, he acted like a madman, making marks on the doors of the gate and letting saliva run down his beard. Achish said to his servants, "Look at the man. He is insane. Why bring him to me? Am I short of madmen that you have to bring me this fellow here to carry on like this in front of me? Must this man come into my house?" So Achish says, get rid of this guy. Now, David, we're going to just chapter 22 real quick. David left Gath and escaped to the Cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and his father's household heard about it, they went down to him there. And all those who were in distress or in debt or discontented gathered around him, and he became their commander. Just highlight that. All those who were distressed, in debt, and discontented, they were the ones that gathered around David. There were about 400 of them. And from there, David went to Mizpah in Moab and said to the king of Moab, would you let my father and mother come and stay with you until I learn what God will do for me? So he left them with the king of Moab, and they stayed with him as long as David was in the stronghold. Remember the woman Ruth? Ruth is a Moabitess. David actually has some Moabite. He's part Moabite through his great-grandmother. And so, but evidently he probably in some way, maybe because of his position, he knew the king of Moab. So his family, he takes his family there, his father and mother, he left them with the king. And so the prophet Gad said to David, do not stay in the stronghold, go into the land of Judah. So David left and went to the forest of Hereth. Now Saul heard that David and his men had been discovered, and Saul was seated, spear in hand, under the tamarisk tree on the hill at Gibeah, with all his officials standing at his side. And he said to them, listen, men of Benjamin, will the son of Jesse give you fields and vineyards? Will he make all of you commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds? Is that why you have all conspired against me? So here's the paranoia of Saul coming out. No one tells me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse, none of you is concerned about me or tells me that my son has incited my servant to lie in wait for me as he does today. So Saul's got in his whole, he's got this whole paranoid thing in his mind that David's actually trying to kill him. David's trying to get away from Saul. He's not trying to kill him, but it's his own paranoia that's led him to these conclusions. But Doeg, the Edomite, who was standing with Saul's officials, said, I saw the son of Jesse come to Ahimelech, son of Ahitub, at Nob. Ahimelech inquired of the Lord for him. He also gave him provisions and the sword of Goliath, the Philistine. Then the king sent for the priest, Ahimelech, son of Ahitub, and all the men of his family who were the priest at Nob, and they all came to the king. Saul said, listen now, son of Ahitub. Yes, my lord, he answered. Saul said to him, why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, giving him bread and a sword and inquiring of God for him, so that he has rebelled against me and lies in wait for me as he does today? Ahimelech answered the king. Listen to this response. This is a great one. Who of all the king's servants is as loyal as David, the king's son-in-law, captain of your bodyguard and highly respected in your household? So Ahimelech's pushing back on Saul here. Was that day the first time I inquired of God for him? Of course not. Let not the king accuse your servant of any of his father's family, for your servant knows nothing at all about this whole affair. In other words, he's saying, there is no conspiracy against you, and I'm certainly not involved in any conspiracy. I don't know anything about that. But the king said, you will surely die, Ahimelech, you and your whole family. Then the king ordered the guards at his side, turn and kill the priest of the Lord, because they too have sided with David. They knew he was fleeing, yet they did not tell me. But the king's officials were unwilling to raise a hand to strike the priest of the Lord. The king then ordered Doeg, you turn and strike down the priest. So Doeg the Edomite. Now remember, the Edomites are the descendants of Esau. Remember, Esau is the brother of Jacob. So, but he's an outside guy who's come in. So Doeg the Edomite turned and struck them down. That day he killed 85 men who wore the linen ephod. So they slaughtered 85 priests. He also put to the sword Nob, the town of the priest, with its men and women, its children, its infants, and its cattle, donkeys, and sheep. So Doeg led this slaughter against the people of Nob. But one of Ahimelech's son of Ahitub named, named Abiathar, here's the man we talked about earlier, escaped and fled to join David. He told David that Saul had killed the priest of the Lord. Then David said to Abiathar, that day when Doeg the Edomite was there, I knew he would be sure to tell Saul, I am responsible for the death of your family. Stay with me. Don't be afraid. The man who wants to kill you is trying to kill me too, and you will be safe with me. So this is just going from bad to worse here with Saul. But here's what I want us to close with. Back to verse 2 of chapter 22. All those who were in distress or in debt or discontented gathered around him, and he became their commander. Remember, David is a type. In Scripture, David is a type of Christ. And what's said of David here is really so true about Jesus as well, isn't it? The people that come to Jesus are, this is a description, distressed, in debt, discontented. And God is working in our lives to bring us to Christ. So oftentimes what he will do is he will allow us to be distressed or in debt or discontented so that we'll turn to him and seek him. You know, it's fairly common to see that most of the time the people that come to the Lord come because there's something in their life that has been, you know, turned upside down or something. You know, they're in some sort of distress, or there's just a discontentment with the way things are, or some kind of a crisis is often the very thing that nudges us in that direction. And that's one of the reasons why the Lord allows things to happen. Because if, you know, the truth of the matter is, when a person is living in comfort and in luxury and in success and, you know, got no problems, of course, the last thing anybody's thinking about is God. Nobody's thinking about their own eternal well-being. You know, those things don't cross the mind of a person when everything's going well. And so God stirs things up. He allows challenges and troubles and difficulties to come, but it's that he might cause us to reconsider, that our eyes might be opened. And then when we realize that we're in trouble, when I sense my distress, or when I realize my debt, when that discontentment sets in and I start to say, man, what is life really all about? Or is there an answer to this? Or how can, you know, what about this thing or these things? You know, where can I turn? And there the Lord again makes a way for us to realize that he's the one. And he wants to become, like we read here, he wants to become the commander over us. He wants to take over our lives, to be the Lord of our lives. And so maybe tonight you're in a place like that, distressed, debt, discontented. And even as a believer, maybe you're there. What's the answer? Well, just get closer to the Lord. Just yield more thoroughly to your captain, to your commander. And allow him to have that place in your life. And the interesting thing about these guys here is you find that these men that were with David during this season of exile, these are the men that become what the Bible refers to as David's mighty men during the time when he actually takes the throne and becomes the king over the nation. It's these ones that were with him in that place, who were driven there by these circumstances and were with him during the hardship. These were the ones, they were all, you know, being forged together to be the leaders of the kingdom when God would establish it. So God uses those things in our lives, like he used those things in David's life for preparation. So do not despise the discipline of the Lord, but know that those are the things that he's using to make us the people that he wants us to be. So, Lord, we thank you for your word. We thank you for these wonderful. Lord, just these stories, they're true stories, and that we can glean from them and learn from them, and you can speak to us from them. So help us to learn the lessons that will cause us to be more and more in that place where we are following you, where we are living in submission to you, where we are ultimately loving you and doing your will. Help us to know that there's no better place to be. Even when it's hard, there's no better place to be. So thank you for your word. In Jesus' name, amen.